Hey, everybody, and welcome to Learning from Smart People. I am your host, Rob Oliver, and I appreciate you being here with me today. I just want to give a quick shout out for some cool things that are happening with the show. I was just notified by FeedSpot that our humble little podcast has been officially listed as one of the 30 entrepreneurial podcasts that you should be listening to in 2021, which I thought was really cool. And I wanted to share that with you and let you know we're going places and we're being recognized, and that's cool. And the reason that we're being recognized is because of the smart people that we are learning from. And my smart person today is Robert McPhee. He is a coach and consultant who helps people live fantastic lives by making more decisions based on their vision and values rather than stress and pressure. And as a side note, he's also a really great dad. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thrilled to be here, and congratulations on the recognition. I didn't know that, but that's a big deal. You know, with the number of podcasts that are out there, that is really a big deal. So congratulations on that.
Well, thank you very much. I was very honored to get that, and I'm excited about it. And, you know, it's one of those things that, of course, my mom and dad listen to the show and they think it's wonderful, but having some outside recognition that says, hey, this is something you should be listening to. Not that mom and dad's opinion isn't wonderful, but my mom thinks everything that I do is amazing, at which is why she is also like you being a great dad. She's an amazing mom because she firmly believes in and supports everything I do. So shout out to my mom for that.
Yeah, that's so funny, because I always joke with people about being on podcasts, and sometimes I'm pretty clear that someone's mom is the only one listening when I'm on a podcast.
Yeah.
And again, that's a really good reason to be very proud of that kind of recognition from a source like that. So
cool. Well, thank you very much. So let's jump right into this. The reason I had you on is because I was reading your bio and there were two words that jumped out at me, and they are excellent decisions. All right. And it's the name of one of your books, if I'm not mistaken. And so, listen, I've got three kids, okay? And what I want to impress them with is the power of the decisions that they make and how to have some kind of process that helps them to make not just good decisions, but to make excellent decisions. So let me just ask, what kind of is your background, and where did you come up with the idea of excellent decisions?
All right. Well, it's interesting. We both have three kids, and this whole idea of excellent decisions partially came out of working with young people and my own experience as a parent. And my own kids are grown and out of the house and doing really well. And I tell people I had an unfair advantage as a parent, because part of my background is I was the director of training for Jack Canfield. And Jack is best known as the co-creator of the Chicken Soup for the Soul book series. But I actually worked with him on the side of his business connected to another book he wrote called The Success Principles. And we were doing live trainings and mastermind groups and all that type of stuff. And I was running all that for him while my kids were growing up. So he was an incredible mentor and really the source of a lot of the work that I do. But he was also an incredible influence on me as a parent. So, you know, as my children were growing up, they were learning the principles, you know, the fundamental principles of how to live a successful and happy and fulfilling and satisfying life without having to, you know, sit them down at the dinner table every Friday night and have a pop quiz or have, you know, PowerPoint slides and flip charts, you know, whatever. They just grew up in conversations like that. And it's interesting because now they hold me accountable to those kinds of principles. They call me when I'm not kind of living the kind of ideas that I teach. But one of the things I observed, you kind of gave the definition of what I use for excellent decisions, which is when we're making decisions based on our vision and our values and what's really important to us, rather than all the stress and pressure that we're faced with in today's world. And, you know, the stress and pressure is incredible. You know, and for our young people, again, it's a perfect example, the peer pressure, the social pressure, the academic pressure, the parental pressure that they're under. And a lot of times no one's really working with them to help them get really clear about just what's important to them. My wife does college consulting, and there's a lot of parents out there who are very clear about what they want for their children and what's important to their children. But in a lot of cases, they're not asking them, like, what's really important to you? You know, what do you want to do? What's your vision of the kind of life you want to lead? And when, in my experience, when that is what's driving the decisions that people are making, then life just works a lot better. We get more done. We accomplish more. I'm all for that. But more importantly, we have the kind of experience of life that we really want to have. So again, it really started with young people. A big part of my background was the work with Jack, and a lot of my work is based on the work that I did with him. And I actually shifted. You said one of my books is called Excellent Decisions, which it is, but it's actually a retitling of a previous book. I wrote a book in 2010 called Manifesting for Non-Gurus. And the idea was that anybody can manifest, anybody can create amazing things in their life, and they don't need to go live in a cave in India for 10 years in order to be able to do it. But what I learned was that Manifesting for Non-Gurus is a clever title, but a horrible brand. And now all my branding is built around this concept of excellent decisions. And much like you said, the way you responded to reading that bio is pretty much the response I get. People understand how important decisions are, and they want to make more excellent decisions. So it's a much more positive response than what I was getting before.
It's a very empowering message, because where I come from, I mentioned this already, I have a disability. I acquired that disability when I was 21. And there are a lot of people who have adverse experiences in their lives, who go through difficult times, and they feel as though almost the decision-making power was taken away from them. And mm-hmm. they end up in a kind of a victimhood, or, you know, they talk about what happened, and they talk about how there are many things that they can't do or whatever it is, but they lose the ability to see that all of us make decisions, and the decisions that we make every day, no matter how big or small, have the potential to make a huge impact. And I would assume that it's making an impact not just in your life, but in the lives of those around you. Is that a true statement?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's an interesting expression called we teach what we most need to learn. So I'm still a big student of this whole conversation as well. And listening to you, I'm just really struck. There's really two critical things about decision making. Like you said, it's in the middle of everything we do. But it's so closely connected. And I love your example about people who are faced with adversity. My youngest daughter was born with an injury. And we saw as parents how differently families responded to that and the lessons that were taught. And, you know, going back to the Canfield work, the number one principle in Jack's book is about taking personal responsibility and remembering that we have choices, that no matter what happens in our life, we have a choice, we have a decision to make about how to respond to that. So I don't know the specifics of your situation, but, you know, at that young age, you were faced with a decision, like a choice to make about how you were going to respond to the circumstances that you were facing. And so decisions are really critical in that way. But there's another way that they're really critical, which is that, you know, and I think you're probably like me, you're deeply immersed in the whole personal development world and looking for ways to keep learning and growing and you know, I love that. I could be in that all the time, you know, and doing all the inner work and growing and all that. But there's also a point where we need to get out in the world and we need to engage. You know, you've created this podcast. You're out there actively engaging with people. You're learning from people. You're sharing what you're learning with other people. You're taking action and engaging. And the truth is, the decisions that we make are the bridge between those two worlds. I see people who get so deeply immersed in that world of personal development that they never make a decision to take action. And they're, you know, they're those people that are in the cave and meditating and all those wonderful things, which I'm a big fan of. But they never make a decision to take action and really get out there and participate. And then we have people who are so actively participating, they never pause and reflect and do that inner work. So again, to me, the decisions we make are the bridge between those two. And it's why decisions are so important. And it's why I love focusing on helping people make more excellent decisions.
You know, it's really interesting that you talk about that, because from my personal experience, I look at things, I've looked at that a little bit different, okay? And for me, I was looking at it kind of as the screen between the inside and the outside world. So my body is that screen. I've got what's going on inside, and then there's what's going on in the world around me. And a lot of times when people look at me, they, because of my disability, they see what is kind of on the screen and they don't see what's going on behind it, if that makes any sense. And what you're talking about is not allowed, it's building a bridge so that that image, that screen, that you know, stereotype, whatever it is that's there, is kind of broken down by the decisions that you're making and what you're doing. And I love that idea. And in some ways, I want to go back and just highlight something that you said. When you were working with Canfield and your kids are growing up, they're growing up in an environment where they're soaking all this stuff up without sitting down in conferences and without, you know, reading books and getting PowerPoints and all of those things. My dad's a math teacher, okay? And I grew up in an environment where he thinks math and he communicates as a mathematician. He never sat down and taught me math. I picked up on math and I do well at it. And the reason I do that, I think, is just because that's how he lives and communicates and thinks. And that's what I picked up from him almost by osmosis, just by being around him. And does that, I think that same thing applies with the environment that your kids were growing up in.
Yeah, absolutely. And it almost becomes like hardwired. And I have two daughters and a son, and my oldest daughter is a math PhD. So we should get her together with your dad. They could have some interesting conversations.
But, sure.
But I'm really struck actually by my younger daughter, who I was telling you, she's the one who had the injury when she was born. And a story that I often tell when I'm talking about that idea of personal responsibility, and it really reflects on how she grew up. When she was in high school, she was playing soccer. She's actually a very good soccer player and a good example of overcoming what doctors told us she'd never be able to do based on her injury.
Sure.
But she had a soccer game coming up, and I had a big meeting related to work. And I told my daughter, I said, I can't go to your soccer game on Friday because I have this meeting. And she looked at me and she kind of crossed her arms and rolled her eyes back in her head. And she said, "You can't?" And I was like, "Oh, man."
Right.
You know, like here's this kid who grew up in an environment where personal responsibility was the way we live. You know, like we don't say, "I can't," you know,
sure.
Like, you know, that just wasn't. So I had taught her that lesson, right? And now she was just bringing it right back and giving it to me. And in the moment, I was not happy about it. Like, you know, as a parent, you know, I didn't, it was just so much easier for me to say, "I can't go to your game."
Sure.
But as I look back on it now, and shortly afterwards, when I was looking back on it, I was so thrilled that she got that lesson, that she really understood the distinction of the language that we use. And the truth is, I could go to her game. I was making a decision based on what was important to me. This meeting was a big deal. I don't remember what the meeting was, but it was something important. So I was saying, you know what? I'm choosing not to go to your game. I'm choosing to go. But, you know, she's my daughter. I love her so much. It was much easier to just say, "I can't go." But that's what we do. You know, we do the easy thing. We blame it on the meeting, you know, like, "Oh, I love you. I'd like to go to your game, but I can't."
Right.
But the truth is, and she forced me to reframe it and say, "You know what? I'm choosing to go to this meeting instead of your game. And I promise I'll go to your game on Monday," whatever it was.
Right.
But, you know, she did. She grew up in an environment. And again, there was never a time where we taught that lesson and put it on the blackboard or whatever.
Right.
But she got it to that level where she not only heard what I said the way she heard it, but she was willing to call me on it. And to this day, I'm thrilled. Like, I could tell you stories for hours about things she calls me on to this day. So
right. But let me point something out there, and that is, for all of the parents out there that have kids, your kids learn more from what you do and the way that you express yourself than they do from any lecture or any, you know, sit down and, for lack of a better term, come to Jesus conversation that you may have with them. They see the way that you live. They know the way that you make decisions, and those things are all being... they're shaping and they're molding the way that your kids look at life. And that's so powerful. And I guess, let me just kind of use this as a segue, I think, because as a parent, we have kind of this comfort zone where we sit, right? Like, I'm the dad, you're the child. I tell you I can't come to your game, and you say, oh, gee, I wish you could come to my game, but I understand that you can't. And her reflecting back to you kind of gives you a push that says, okay, this is not the comfortable parent-daughter relationship that I'm used to. Like, how does that kind of work with, you know, finding what your comfort zone is and then kind of being pushed outside of that sometimes?
Yeah. Well, comfort zones are so important. And I actually make the awareness of comfort zones a big part of what I teach and how I coach. The way that I define a comfort zone, I'll kind of spoiler alert, you know, I have this whole long explanation of what comfort zones are, but the way that I define a comfort zone is that when our self-image, like our beliefs about who we are, match our behavior, like what's showing up in the world, then we're in a comfort zone. And that can be a good thing or it can be a bad thing. You know, I can see myself as a really healthy, fit person, and I look in the mirror and I see someone who's in good shape, and I'm comfortable because those two things match. It's going back to the math thing. You know, it's almost like an equation. It balances out and I'm comfortable and everything's okay. But people do the exact opposite. You have people who have adopted a belief about themselves that they're not healthy. You know, I'm overweight. I'm out of shape. I don't like to exercise. That's their self-talk. That's their belief about themselves. And chances are they're looking in the mirror and seeing someone who's overweight and out of shape and doesn't exercise. And that person, by the definition of, you know, when your self-image matches the results you're getting, they're comfortable as well. But it's not working for them. They're not happy. They're not content. But they're comfortable. And in the situation with the parent relationship, I think that's a really good example. We, as parents, we have this role that we're expected to play. But my self-image as a parent was very different because of the work that I was doing. I saw myself more as like a teacher and a role model in some ways, but not like a I'm going to tell you what to do kind of way. And as a result, that conversation that I described to you is possible. And when people really get that understanding of what a comfort, because almost everyone has had someone say to them, oh, you need to get out of your comfort zone. You need to expand your comfort zone, right? And the truth is, I think we all agree with that. It sounds good. It makes sense.
On paper, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, but most people don't know, like, what does that mean? How do I do that? And when we break it down, I love the math connection that you made earlier. When we really look at it mathematically and we say, okay, what is my current self-image and what are the results I'm getting? If we want to change it, we can either change our self-image or we can change what we're doing to create the results. And ideally, we're going to change both and create a new comfort zone. But for most people, it's very empowering to at least understand how that works.
Right.
And the way that I teach it, the way that I support my clients and the people that I'm working with, is to start with the self-image. Look at your current beliefs and change those first, which will make you very uncomfortable. You know, if you're that person who's currently out of shape and overweight, and I tell you to, you know, create a self-image of someone who's, you know, healthy and fit, and your voice in your head is going to go, what? You are not. Look in the mirror, blah, 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 right?
Right.
And that's just trying to stay comfortable. That's just your mind trying to keep you comfortable. But if people adopt that new self-image and then they start getting ideas for what they can do to get healthier, you know, eating better, moving more, getting more exercise, whatever it is, at some point those actions will create a new result that matches the new self-image. You've created a new comfort zone, and that's to me, that's the key to lasting results, getting a result that will really be sustainable.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever had anyone explain what a comfort zone is, because I mean, we talk about it and everybody kind of has this general idea of what it is, but no one has ever explained, like, okay, a comfort zone is when your self-image and your state of being.
Yeah. The results
match it. Yeah. Incredible. And I also think that in our current society, a lot of times comfort zones are talked about as being bad, and they're not necessarily always bad, as you've said.
No, they're not good. They're not bad. They just are. And you know, the truth is, just as human beings, we don't like being uncomfortable.
Right.
Like, we know it's important to get out of our comfort zone. But if, somebody comes into my office today and says, "Oh, Robert, I got great news for you. This is going to make you really uncomfortable." I don't go, "Oh, good, growth opportunity." I go, "No, I don't want to be uncomfortable. Right. I want to be comfortable."
Well, okay, but I was even thinking about it. Like, if you spend all of your life being uncomfortable, if you spend all of your time being outside of your comfort zone, it's got to be an extremely stressful place. Like, and the opportunity for growth under stress is not as healthy. Like, there's got to be somewhere that you can be and be comfortable and be willing to grow and be, all of those things. And yeah, it's all part of it. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And it's so true. And it's again, why this whole idea of making excellent decisions and making decisions and living your life in alignment with your vision and your values, to me, it always circles back to that. Because the truth is, if you're in a comfort zone, but it's not what you want, what it really means is you're outside of your vision and your values. I don't think anybody really holds a powerful vision of being overweight and out of shape and not exercising and not taking care of themselves. Most of us have a vision. If we really look at our desired vision, it would be to be healthy and well and vibrant and energetic. That would be our vision. And we would want to be creating results that match that vision instead of creating results that match what might be our current reality based on, whatever. It could be, environments that we've been in or other influences that we've had, whatever it is, all those stresses and pressures that we talk about. But the trick is not to live your life completely outside of your comfort zone. The game to me is to create new comfort zones based on our vision and values, based on what we really want. Because when we start with that and get new ideas and new thoughts about what to do to create it, and then start taking those actions, which ultimately create the results, then, we end up in that new comfort zone. And like for me, I've been a runner for years. I've just been active. My wife is great about making sure we have really good food in the house, so I eat well. And I just have a very strong image of being a healthy, fit person, and the result tends to show up because I exercise and eat well. It's not uncomfortable for me. It's not extra effort. It's not stress. It's not struggle. It just happens easily and effortlessly. But it does require work. It isn't accidental. I do have to exercise. I do have to eat well. But it's not a struggle. It's not effort, because the results I want match my current self-image. That's my comfort zone.
Right. Okay. So we've covered a lot of material here. And I'm just thinking, in the couple minutes that we've got left, we talked about, decision-making and as parents and decision-making for young people. But the show is geared towards entrepreneurs and business leaders. So can you just talk briefly about the concept of excellent decisions as it relates to the entrepreneurs and the business world today?
Yes. Well, to me, it's a leadership question. If someone is truly an entrepreneur, they've taken on a leadership role. People can be entrepreneurial within a large organization, especially if they're in a leadership role. And all these ideas, all these concepts that we've talked about today, really all the work that I do is so relevant to leaders, because leaders are setting the example. Leaders are setting the tone for the people that are designated to follow them, or in some cases, even if they're not in a leadership role, a specifically designated leadership role. I've worked with organizations where some of the most effective leaders are not the managers and the supervisors and the leading staff. It's some of the frontline people who are sometimes some of the most effective leaders. And truthfully, I tell people that if you really look at the concept, the simple concept of making excellent decisions, making decisions based on vision and values rather than stress and pressure, there's literally a definition of effective leadership right there. Because if leaders are spending their time responding to all the stress and pressure and have lost connection to the vision and values that they personally hold and that the organization holds, then how could they be an effective leader? And the opposite is true as well. If they're consistently making decisions and if they're consistently really closely connected to the vision and the values that they personally hold and that hopefully match the vision and values of the organization, how can they not be an effective leader? It literally, to me, is the definition of effective leadership, different in different cases, depending on the difference in the vision and values.
That is so, so powerful, amazing. And yet it comes down to the basic principle is you need to know what your vision and values are to start off with. Is there, yeah, we've got a couple minutes, but like, do you have, Is there a simple way to help people find out what their vision and values are, or clarify what those are? Because you're if that's the basis that you're making your decisions on,
right?
If you don't have that, then your ability to make those excellent decisions has been compromised.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, and again, I understand we have limited time, and it's you know, we could do 12 different episodes on those questions. But I will tell you this, in the context of values, the work that I do is really focused on the question, what's important to you, as a way of examining values. So, you know, 30,000 foot view, looking at it really broadly, if you can spend some time with that question, what is important to me? And not what's important to anybody else. That's where the stress and pressure comes in. But really, what's important to me? And I encourage people to look at it from two different angles. One is literally, what is important to me? What are the things, what are the accomplishments that are really important to me? But then the other side of that is to look at what I call states of being. Like, how do I want to be? How do I want to show up? What qualities and characteristics do I want to exude? And that's another kind of values. And I'll give you some examples from my own life. Like, some of the things, some of the what's important to me are my children. You've heard me talk about my children. You can tell that something is really important to me. My own health and well-being is really important to me. The planet and the people, the other people on the planet, that's really important to me. Those are some of my highest values. But then on the states of being side, three of my highest values there are what I call awareness and humility and care. Like, you know, at the end of my life, I would like people to look at me and say, you know what, he was really committed to lifelong learning and awareness and paying attention to what was going on around him. I'd like people to say he was someone who was really humble and someone who genuinely cared. Those are states of being that are really important to me. And that's not to say that they should be important to you or anyone else. Those are mine. But it's a good question. That's what's important to me.
Yeah.
And the vision piece is really more time-oriented. It's looking ahead. As I look forward in my life, as I look, you just heard me do it, you know, when I get to the end of my life, I'm looking forward, saying, what do I want? Like, how do I want this to go? And that could be, what kinds of things do I want to accomplish? But I also really encourage people to remember, accomplishments are great. I'm all for making more money and driving nice cars and living a nice house. That's all cool. I'm fine with that. But don't forget to ask yourself about the experiences that you want to have, because there's way too many people out there who have a nice car and a nice house and a lot of money, and they're miserable. Yeah. You know, they're just miserable. And that to me is a real shame, because it's possible to be really happy and really fulfilled and really satisfied in this experience of life.
Yeah, to take that full circle and go back to parenting, I've often thought this about parents. As a parent, sometimes we spend so much time working to provide for our kids that we forget the fact our kids don't want stuff. Our kids need the experience. Our kids want us, and they want that connection. So that's kind of what I see. Provide for your kids. Do what you can for them, but don't ever forget that the biggest investment is that you can give them is the investment of your time and yourself. Listen.
Well, that's relevant. That's relevant to leadership as well. You know, we can have this conversation all around parenting, and leaders and entrepreneurs can listen and apply the principles exactly to leadership the same way it applies to parenting.
Yeah. And I think you're right on that. These are principles that are universal when it comes to leadership. Fantastic. Robert, you have been wonderful. If people are looking to get a hold of you on the web, what's the best way to find you?
Simplest way, you know, it's all the branding, right? It's all about excellent decisions. So if people go to excellentdecisions.com, you'll find out all about me. A couple of things that we talked about here, if people want a little more in-depth information, especially about that comfort zone conversation that we had, I created a video to explain the model that we use to help people understand comfort zones, and that video is available. If people go to excellentdecisions.com/joy, J-O-Y, you'll get actually a free PDF copy of my book and a video. It's about a 30-minute video that goes through a 4-part model in really good depth about that idea of comfort zones and why they're so important and how decisions fall into that model.
Fantastic. I will put that in the show notes, and hopefully people take advantage of that. So, Robert, thank you so much. We have learned from you. You are indeed smart. It's time for three questions to establish your humanity. Are you ready for this?
Wow, I don't know. It feels a little game showish, but I'm ready. Throw it out.
All right. So, what is one thing that you are afraid of?
One thing I'm afraid of, the first thing that comes up is not being able to provide for my children to the degree that I want to provide for them. It's so interesting that that comes up because they're all doing so well. I really shouldn't have to worry about that. But again, in terms of values, that's something that's so important to me. Around my business, that comes up as a fear, like not being able to do enough, not being able to be there for them to the degree that I really want to. That's a fear that comes up for me, especially again around work.
Okay, if you were going to have something to decorate your refrigerator for your adult children, what accomplishments of your adult children would you put up on the fridge in the way that you would have put up something that they accomplished in elementary school?
I've got it right here. I can show you. I can reach back and grab it. I'm participating right now in a mentor program. And yesterday we did a 5K. And so this is what I would put on the refrigerator. And if you're just listening to the audio, it's actually a race number that I got for participating in this 5K. And again, you know, it's so funny because as we're having this conversation, it keeps going back to the vision and the values, right? Because again, the health and wellness is a real priority for me. It's something that's lived on with my kids when they're around. We go for a run together. So it connects really well. But that's something right in my experience this week that I would want to put up on the refrigerator as an accomplishment for myself.
It's awesome. I love it. Okay, the weather is starting to warm up and we're going towards summer. What is the summer family activity that will bring everybody together, in your family?
Gosh, you know, with the whole pandemic, you know, as we're recording this, it's all kind of winding down and we're going to be able to get together again. But one of the hardest things is not being able to get together with family and not seeing my kids. They're scattered. I'm in Northern California. I've got one in Seattle and one in Denver and one in Washington, D.C. So we really haven't seen them. But I'll tell you, the first thing that comes up as an activity is cornhole, because when they're all here at the house, we have a nice backyard and we love to break out the cornhole and get some pretty competitive cornhole games going. But you know, it doesn't even matter what the activity is. It's such a great question because it reminds me that, you know, we live in the wine country. We could all be going wine tasting. That would accomplish the same thing. We could be playing cornhole. We could be going for a walk. It really doesn't matter, but it's that outcome, again, that experience of just being together and experiencing family. So
Yeah.
thank you for that question. I'll take it into the rest of my day.
Absolutely. Okay, just as a follow-up question, what's on the menu during the cornhole games?
What's on the menu?
Yeah.
Well, wine. Again, we're here in the wine country,
Okay.
so I've only lived here for about 4 years, but I've pretty much become a total wine snob living here in Sonoma, California. So good quality red wine has become something that's always on the menu. And because it's outside, we'd be grilling something, you know, maybe a nice piece of fish on the grill would be a good thing to be having.
Fantastic. Robert McPhee, thank you so much for being here. You've been fantastic and you have shared so much information for us. Thank you. To all my listeners, thank you so much for being here as well. I would encourage you subscribe, whether you're on YouTube, whether you're on a podcast platform, wherever it is, click the subscribe button, click the notification button, make sure you don't miss an episode, and I will remind you, as always, that when you stop learning, you stop living. Have a great day, everybody.